inviting our mindfulness to extend to this present presence, each of us and all that we're connected to, our friends, family, communities, this space and all the intentions that went into providing it, and the people who maintain it as well. And also the past, parents, grandparents, ancestors, and progenitors, evolution, life, the world, and the karma that comes with that, all our inheritance that's expressing now through body, speech, and mind, and stems from habits, largely. On the negative side, discursive thinking and afflictive emotions, the five hindrances of Buddhism. That include and impute and sort of have as their background an idea of self, an individual self that's permanent. So the hindrances are greed, essentially grasping or attachment or clinging or even envy and jealousy, avarice. That's the self trying to pull things into itself because it wants, because it desires. And the anger, pushing away, aversion. I don't want to be that. The self pushing away. Ignorance even has an imputed self which willfully ignores. So that's the third hindrance. The fourth is slothfulness, laziness. And we all know that. And restless worry or anxious worry, which is the self trying to make sure that it didn't miss something or that it's got it all. In my case, my particular hindrance. So given all that as part of this present presence with us, I'd like to go back to mindfulness of this presence and the four foundations of mindfulness. The first sutra, which says that if there's no self, no permanent self, no essential focus that's the master or controller or owner, proprietor of all this, then there are four foundations for mindfulness still. And those are awareness of thinking within the thinking, awareness of mind and its mental objects within the mind, awareness of feelings, emotions, including the five hindrances, within the feelings, and awareness of body, sensations, impressions, even this present presence within the body. Awareness of change. All these are changing, body, feelings, mind, continuously. Impermanence. And with that awareness, and with there's a dissolution of desire that feeds the hindrances, that in turn feeds the thinking, and a cessation of the delusion, or at least a diminution of the delusion that there's a self that's getting something out of this. And finally, a letting go of the thoughts that sort of build up the self. So with mindfulness in this fourfold foundation as a base, there's also investigation of Dharma, investigation of what is this, who am I, what is. that sitting in this particular upright posture with mindfulness investigating leads naturally to the arising of energies within the body, in the mind, joy, and ease or tranquility. All those support concentration and several levels of concentration, the jhanas that I'll talk about mostly, and equanimity. The jhanas are so-called levels or stages of concentration. And the first level, these all come from a sutra called the Pothapada Sutra, mostly, and they were referenced in other sutras as well. But it's a dialogue between the Buddha and between sort of a large collection of people who are not his followers and not his disciples. And they're led by it's a dialogue between the Buddha and the leader of this group, whose name is Pothapada. So it's kind of a rough environment, and the main part of the sutra itself is just about a page or so, and that deals with the stages of concentration. The first stage is to approach it, one has to first set aside the five hindrances, set aside immediate desires, including sleepiness, maybe. And once the question at hand is really what brings about the end, the cessation of particular perception, then that's what the Buddha is asked to begin this particular sutra. So he comes to the first stage, and it's to basically this: mindfully investigating, having set aside the five hindrances, just sitting, thinking, the sustained application of thinking, investigating this. And these stages are used as the foundation for people going off into caves and sitting for years trying to practice, or in many cases, Zen practice, some master telling a disciple to practice a given stage for perhaps months. But that's not apparent in the sutra. It sounds like you could almost go through the stages one by one just by following his suggestion. Each stage is marked with its own kind of perception, a sense of arising joy, happiness, and tranquility on the first stage, and investigating and thinking, just being aware and awake and with tranquility and concentration. But eventually one gets through that stage if one practices diligently and moves beyond. In this case, beyond the sustained application of thinking. So, in my mind, I associate that with at least the first stage of just sitting, non-thinking, which is essentially the definition of shikantaza, our practice. One suggestion for it. But the non-thinking really means beyond thinking, and it doesn't mean that there are no thoughts. It means that when the self that was thinking diligently has sort of gotten tired of being that self and has dropped down a level of refinement to a new, more refined sense of self, and being, just sitting, non-thinking, concentrating. And that stage too, like every stage, has its own sense of joy, happiness, tranquility, peace, very deep sense. The next stage is very similar. One eventually, oneself, the self that is just sitting non-thinking particularly, drops down a bit to a more refined sense of practice. In this case, letting go of both itself and the sense of concentration, leading to the third stage, which is equanimity. And its own deep sense of happiness, having gone beyond the concentrating practice. The fourth stage is called, again, going beyond the practice of equanimity, again, the self moving toward a more refined perception. This new perception is one of beyond pleasure and pain. So, for example, in this sitting, beyond worrying about our legs or our back or our tight phage muscles, in my case, just again sinking into the happiness and tranquility, having gone even beyond the practice of equanimity. And that's the fourth and final stage of the first four stages, which are called rupa, form, meditations on form. The next four stages are much easier to appreciate, interestingly. They're called formless arupa stages. The fifth stage is limitless space. Or in the sutra we just chanted, boundlessness. I'm not necessarily caught up within this skin. There's perception, a clear perception arising, having gone beyond the perception of tranquility and the practice of tranquility on the fourth stage, a more refined perception of the truth of infinite space, not boundedness. With every stage, the self that was holding on to that practice, doing the practice, eventually loses interest and gets tired and drops to a more refined level. And a new sense of self, or of truth, more refined sense arises. The sixth stage is the infinite space. In Thich Nhat Hanh's words, the infinite space, the practicer realizes that the infinite space is not just infinite space, it's tied to the five elements, the floor, the ceiling, the space within. And it's interdependent, co-arising. It is in connection with the space only. There's no individuality. So the sixth stage is that is replaced with a sense of perception of infinite consciousness. These begin more to be more like a roadmap of where we're going, not something that we commonly experience. I'll come back to that later. The seventh stage is nothing, nothingness. codependent arising. Nothing exists in and of itself. No self. No individual identity to anything. The individual identities are just labels that we had associated our names. But beyond that, there's nothing that's independent of itself. The flower is part of the sun and part of the ground and part of the atmosphere and partakes of all of them and contributes to them. So the eighth and final stage is beyond perception. And remembering that the Buddha's original objective was to look toward the cessation, the end of perception in this. And he's giving sort of a roadmap for how to do it to this group of non-disciples. The ninth and final stage is arrived at beyond perception, beyond non-perception. Going beyond doesn't mean the end of perception, just as going beyond just sitting to just sitting non-thinking doesn't mean the end of thinking. It just means the end of the individual karma associated with that perception, the individual possessiveness or pushing away. In my mind, I equate that in our practice with just with disappearing in the sitting. One is just the sitting. There is just the sitting. In one of the Zen Mind Beginner's Mind on the chapter that's relevant, he says, when we sit, we are nothing. We do not even realize where we are, what we are. We just sit. But there is creativity when we awaken. It's one of three kinds of creativity that he describes. We create ourselves, we recreate our egos, etc. We create our individuality. The ninth state is also associated with arhats and very advanced beings in Buddhist lore. So to my mind, I think all of these stages and all of these experiences are common to each of us. Particularly in sesshins, there we bump into boundless space and boundless consciousness, and certainly just sitting non-thinking. And they persist for some time. We walk out of the zendo and lo and behold, it's there's no separation. We're part of it all. But those come and go and they go away. So these practices are described in various points as just practices that one uses. They're not the way ordinary mind. From the perspective of the paramitas, we just had a week-long session on the paramitas, and I think that really helps illuminate the stages. But the first paramita, the six perfections, is giving. And the chapter that I alluded to in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, is also on giving, where he describes sitting, when we're sitting, we're nothing. And he also describes in that same section on giving that to give is just not to attach. I think Peter probably brought that up during the session itself, just as we go from moment to moment, not attaching to anything, that is to give. Um, Koban, the founder of this Zendo, was the source for the disappearing and the sitting ideal. And he says that everything is God, ultimately. Nothing else but God. So there's no essential room for the self in sitting. That's giving. The second paramita is the morality, not being dishonest, which to my mind relates to non-thinking. The third is patience, or in Thich Nhat Hanh's words, inclusiveness, no boundlessness maybe, but it's Milarepa's songs of the Six Perfection as it is, not fearing what is ultimately true, not fearing the ultimate direction, the ultimate being oneness. The fourth paramita is, of course, mindfulness, back to our beginning. Also, in the sixth song of the Six Perfection, the instruction is just practice mindfulness continuously. That's the perseverance, the energy. Fifth paramita, meditation. The song of the Six Perfection is just rest in this present presence. So we're back to both mindfulness and this present presence. And the final perfection, wisdom, is knowing directly how things are, knowing how this is, just sitting.
I've been reading a little of the Dalai Lama, actually a lot of the Dalai Lama, called The Middle Way. And he basically breaks down the 12 links of dependent origination, which is pretty helpful for me. I don't quite understand the function, what he's describing as they all work somehow within karma. And so, and karma's been kind of throwing me, because I can understand the reasoning behind a certain condition, as you described, of where we come from, how my parents were, what the culture was, and the ripple effect of where I am now, and my own behavior, and what I do, what I've done. I just can't seem to understand how this thing about past lives and how the word karma, past lives, it sounds too pagan.
Yeah.
So I can't wrap my mind, or maybe it's just being indoctrinated in the science-based culture I am, modern thinking. I just can't. I don't understand really. I thought maybe.
I share that viewpoint. I don't, in any sense, personally, this is just a personal thing, and I have no deep understanding of karma. There is an issue of the Bodhidharma magazine just came out a month or so ago, and it's all on, or it has a major focus on karma from six different teachers discussing it. But I personally have always disavowed reincarnation. I know the karma that's expressing now through my body, speech, and mind is stuff that came from my parents, grandparents, culture, and my own greed, anger, delusion, ignorance, etc., particularly when I was young. It's all my stuff. And I can't say a word without realizing that every cell is contributing in some way, and every syllable that's coming out is coming out because of some, you know, background impulse that's driving me forward. That's karma. Just expressing a word in the way that we do it. to me. Doug, do you have any better perspective or anybody else on karma? What is it?
Well, there are preconditions to that help to explain what's arising. I've tried to tear it down to even is it you take a certain kind of granite with a certain kind of feldspar in it that dissolves away and it starts breaking as it rolls down the hill into smaller and smaller pieces, and yet the potential for it to break down into its fundamental components, its sand, its clays, the various different kinds of clays, don't happen all at once, they happen over time. And yet, so is that, those set of conditions, chemical conditions, mechanical conditions, are those karmic? So all I can do is raise more questions.
Yeah.
But there's so many traditions that, in a way, not necessarily with great certainty or pronouncement, but just as matter of fact, even I don't know of very many traditions that don't, you know, think about reincarnation as an element of it. And we can even look at our, basically we're reincarnated matter from our ancestors and the surroundings. But when you see, you know, with young kids, and one of my sons happened to, at age six, pick up the violin and go whoop, and basically there was just something there. How does that arise?
That's a question.
Galileo is another example of a guy who was at the peak of what science was at the time, and yet was his fundamental curiosity something that was born only in that this lifetime that he had, or was it a wind that actually came from previous times that just said, I didn't get it yet, I want to get it more, I really want to understand this, and so he, you know, arrived with that. I can see that that's possible, and when they talk about many, 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 many different dimensions, somebody was even mentioned countless dimensions. Mm-hmm. I think Tom Hostetler mentioned that. You know, we don't know. So there's so much we don't know that it's hard to say. Occasionally we get a whiff of something, but to hold to a view of that is problematic.
I just quickly say, one lifetime is not enough to realize that you are God. You're one with God. So, to realize that it's the idea of a self is an illusion, one lifetime is not enough. Or to realize that doing harm to other people comes back to you and ruins your own life, one lifetime is not enough. So, for the sense of if people feel they've been so heavily indoctrinated by the scientific ideology that we live in the West, oh, okay, I'm sorry. But, you know, when you're going to sleep or waking up, you're in this state in between waking and sleeping. Or even when you're in a deep sleep. If you had a deep sleep with no dreams, very, very peaceful, this actually can be a very, very high state, one of the high states, called Turiya in Sanskrit. Yet you know, you remember that when you wake up, it wasn't that you didn't exist, you remember how peaceful that was when you wake up, you remember that. there's always a sense of, you always have a consciousness, is what it really is. You always have awareness, consciousness. So why should that consciousness stop just because your physical body dies? And so that's the real thing. The West, well, you're only a physical body. Oh, okay, well, good luck with that then. Especially when you're dying, you know, how are you going to feel then? Oh my God, I'm so afraid. But if you've gotten in touch with what's eternal, you could call it whatever you want, the soul, whatever, then you're more on friendly terms. You recognize that. That's what keeps coming back. The only reason you keep reincarnating, well, you still have things to learn. When you finally learn, oh, it's all an illusion, we're all one in God, even then, apparently, you're asked to come back. Then it's not from your karma. You're asked to come back to help other people. So even then, so that's my answer to the reincarnation. The question, the jhanas, I find very interesting lately. I've been reading them, and Wikipedia has a nice summary.